Okay, so welcome back to compiler construction. It's been a long time, but last time when we left off with front end of the compiler, we were talking about the idea of realizing a parser by tackling the construction of a parse tree in a bottom-up manner instead of a top-down manner. So what we were talking about was this idea of having a shift reduce parser that would be an entity that keeps a push down and shifts the input regularly off said push down until it reaches a state where it recognizes the right-hand side of the production of its associated grammar with the top of the stack, and then performs a reduce operation, removing said right-hand side of the production and replacing it with its left-hand side. In such a manner, this shift-reduce parser could then try to reconstruct the parse tree. I say try because we quite quickly realized that such a concept is highly non-deterministic in the sense that it needs some criterion on which to decide whether to actually perform reduction or to wait and shift a little bit more to maybe do either a larger reduction or a more meaningful reduction for reaching the actual root symbol. And this idea of performing a kind of a target-oriented reduction led us to take into account the sequence of actions that we have done so far on our way to the current content of the pushdown, and to compare it with what is actually valid part of a parse tree, in the sense that we created a small finite automaton that would be used by the larger shift-reduce parser in order to scan its own pushdown and obtain a hint whether the so far accumulated fractions of trees indicate whether you have to perform a reduction or shift action at that specific moment. With that, we could already reduce the amount of non-determinism in the whole concept, so we could narrow the set of situations in which we would not know whether to reduce or to shift to only a few left. And for those, we now are after even more information about what we can actually do in order to decide whether to shift or to reduce. And the idea for that was to use not only the so far scanned tokens from the input, but also have, like we did in the top-down approach, to use a look-ahead window into the remaining input and use that information in order to even more narrow down these situations in which we don't know what to do. And that is the concept that we call LR parsing, parameterized with a number, which gives us the size of the look-ahead window. So in an LR1 parser, what we use is a look-ahead window of one token, and with that we revisit what a valid parse tree looks like and how we can use that in order to redesign our helper finite automaton, this canonical automaton thing, to also carry that look ahead into account. So since I don't know whether you still remember, we, for the helper automaton, we had our states designed as sets of items. Items were these productions with markers somewhere in there. In order to take not only these kind of partially created trees into account, but also what might be a valid look ahead, what we then would have to add is we would have to equip items with a look ahead of the specified size. In our case, that would be a size of 1. So, for our purposes, an LR1 item would be a pair consisting of a standard item, as we know it so far, with, well, its production and a marker. And now, additionally, we would carry a token, in this case, of size 1, or a token sequence of size 1, in this case, just 1 token with us. And this token, if you would consider that as a kind of a typing, this symbol could be taken from the set of follow symbols of the left-hand side of the production. Why is that? Well, this token is somehow associated with the right context of where this production might occur in a tree. So that is all the symbols that can, in principle, be found to the right of the current tree. And that is exactly what our follow set is. And just to remember you what that actually is, it's the union of the first sets of all the things that can appear to the right of such a bee. And yeah, that was what follow one actually meant. In terms of how computation state of an LR1 parser looks like, that would be something like this. We would have this lambda followed by alpha on the push down. That is what we have so far accumulated as work. That is what we have already reconstructed from the input. And an LR1 item that looks like this, which has its marker after this alpha and still has a beta to recognize, together with the look ahead part X, is then an admissible LR1 item in our context if we can reconstruct some valid parse tree is a parse tree that starts with S and on the left part, which is kind of already collapsed or not yet expanded, depending on how you you see that, has all the parts from the gamma together with the alpha, and the beta from the item that we are currently looking at, the X, also from the item that we are looking at, which is the first symbol that occurs in our input, thus the look ahead symbol. And then the only thing that remains is we need to be able to derive the complete rest of the input. If that is the case, then we call this B goes to alpha bullet beta with look ahead X as an admissible LR1 item. So, all in all, if we remember how we set up the characteristic automaton for the LR0 case where we didn't have any look-ahead symbols, we can try to do a kind of a similar approach to the LR1 automaton. So, what we started from was, well, first of all, we need to establish what our states are, and the states are now not sets of just plain items, but it's now LR1 items. That means the items that have this special look-ahead symbol added to them. What is the start state? Well, it is once again this artificial S prime goes to S, and the question is now, what do we choose as a look-ahead symbol for the start state? In general, when we look at valid parse trees, then a valid parse tree is only then valid if it completely yields the or reduces the input that is considered to be a valid input. So, what would be the context of such a thing? Well, you are actually not allowed to have anything remaining in the input after the things that can be reduced to our root node. So that would mean that there can't be any valid symbol there. So we signify that with such an epsilon. In practical cases, you would assume the kind of the end of file symbol as being the appropriate symbol for, or the appropriate look ahead for this start state. Anyway, what are the final states in there? Well, those are kind of similar to the ones that we had in the LR0 automaton. The important part is that the item part of our tuple needs to have a completed item, meaning an item that has the bullet at the very right of its right-hand side. And it actually doesn't really matter what kind of look-ahead symbol we have here. That doesn't play a role for whether the whole thing is a final state or not. So we don't constrain it anything else than its range, where it can be, whatever it can be, it needs to be something that follows a B. Then, for the transitions, how do we set up the transitions in the case of the LR1 automaton? Again, pretty similar to what we did for the LR0 automaton, at least. Let's have a look at these kind of shift transitions here. There, the part that is just dealing with the... that was not intended. It was like this. The LR0 item part is just the same as it was for the LR0 automaton. It's just moving the bullet one to the right when consuming exactly the symbol that is marked in that part. So far, nothing special. And the only thing is, what do we do now with the look-ahead symbol? This X thing, while doing a shift transition? Well, for our purposes, the context of the whole item simply does not change by working our way through the right-hand side of such an item. It still is in the same context as it has been before. So all we do is we copy the original look-ahead symbol and insert it in our new item. So there's just no change here. The method is still the same as it has been for the LR0 automaton. Then, since this LR1 automaton somehow is some more special concept than the LR0 automaton, you can imagine that somehow there needs to be something different than before, and that is where the reduce actions these kind of, it's more of an expansion thing in that case. Yeah, where these expansions kind of come into play. So the part that is dealing with the LR0 item component of our tuple is still the one that we had in the LR0 automaton. But now, the thing is, for this characteristic automaton, what we did was we connected two states with an epsilon transition, because what we saw is that when my marker is in front of a B, what needs to be checked is what we can do when we expand such a B. And for such an action, we then continued with the newly expanded production for B with the marker at the left hand side. And the question is now, what should be the look ahead for this thing? Well, now we can actually use the information that we get from here, our symbol B, which we unfold conceptually in this state, is occurring in the original item next to some sequence of symbols beta. And this beta thing is, in that particular case, the right context of the B thing. So what we should actually do is we should use this beta instead of the blue X as the actual new right context of our LR1 item. So what we do is we take this beta and have a look at its first set, and take that as our new look-ahead symbol for the newly created LR1 item. And only if it turns out that this beta is either epsilon by itself, or whether the first symbol of this beta string actually can be expanded to an epsilon, only then would we one concatenate the result of that with the original right context. Well, you can imagine why we do that, in case that this beta doesn't contribute to any right context. We still need to keep the original right-hand side context for our LR1 item. So we collect all of those in a set, and for each of these look-ahead symbols, we introduce a new LR1 item and a transition for that. So that is, in principle, the difference to the LR0 automaton. In case that we do these epsilon transitions, we need to do more than before. We need to actually track what the right context of the item becomes. And if we do that correctly, we end up with a characteristic LR1 automaton for our system. Yeah. So, once again, we can... our actual goal would be not to deal with too much non-determinism in the finite automaton, so we would prefer to have a deterministic automaton, for which we would want to construct the canonical automaton. And yeah, this can also be quite similar as we did that for the LR0 automaton. The only thing which we need to somehow patch is the same spot that we had for the LR0 automaton, namely, or a thing that was quite similar in the LR0 automaton, And that is the part where we actually do this unfolding, because that is the place where we change the right context or the look-ahead symbols for the items. So the part that does this unfolding is this epsilon closure, delta star. And if you think back to the LR0 case, everything is quite the same if you don't take these things into account. So these are the ones that that are new to the game. So let's have a look at what they do. The whole thing works by starting off with a state Q that is our input that we still need to do the epsilon closure on. And for that, what we do is we inspect the set for all the items that have a marker in them. If they have a marker, and this marker is in front of a non-terminal, then we need to add more items to the original set of items. What are the ones that we need to add? Well, for that we need to check what can be derived from the non-terminal that was marked. And by derived, I mean the closure of the derivation function. So it's not only the direct step, but all the steps that can be done from there. And the results that I get are then strings of symbols, and for all of those that start with a non-terminal, in this case I bind it to C, I take the productions that expand such a C, and with that I construct a new item that I put into the result of the closure. Now, what I still need to do is I need to determine the correct look-ahead symbols for these things, the correct right contexts. And for those, I need to, like we I've done for the characteristic automaton, I need to think about the right-hand side context of the marked symbols. And what that means is I need to take into account all these things, the beta prime and the x prime, and those things are all the symbols that get generated that can be found to the right of these symbols C, which we with which we construct these items afterwards. So that string I take and compute the first symbol that might occur either in the beta prime string, or even if that still turns out to be an empty string, the original context X prime. And all the symbols that I get out of that, I take into the LR1 items that I generate. Okay. Good. With that, we can now come up with kind of a shortcut algorithm for creating the canonical LR1 automaton. States of these things are now sets of LR1 items. The start state is the closure of the start state of the characteristic automaton. So it's still the same that you've known before. Final states are ones that have completed items in there. And transitions mean that what you do is you just shift your bullet one symbol further and perform closure on these things. Sounds simple, but it needs a little bit of adjusting of our so far accumulated algorithmic skills. So let's try that out on an example here. So that is still the same grammar than last time, now just with an explicit version of our S prime goes to E. I think I forgot that last time. I've patched the slides accordingly for last time, and this already has the new S prime there. So that's what we actually mean to do for LR1 construction. The first sets might come into use for our construction here, so that's why I also put it on there. And let's maybe, can we somehow no enlargement. Otherwise it's a bit tedious. Oh no. No. So what I've put on that slide here is the results that we got from last time. So that is the states that where they are constructed with the LR0 algorithm, and turns out that we can somehow reuse a few of the results from there. They're going to change later on in a few other slides, but those we can reuse. Maybe you still remember a little bit how we did all that. The idea was to perform this closure based on evaluating which non-terminals were marked, and then introducing the according productions in there as new items. And for those, we would still scan whether there's newly marked symbols in there. We would add them to our thing, and you probably already realize what the scheme is. You would repeat that over and over again until you have checked all the occurrences of those markers. So that is still the same, but we now need to think about how these right contexts propagate through all that. So let's do that. For the start state, there's a predefined right-hand side context, and in the start condition, well, there needs to be no context or end of file context, and we would signify that with an epsilon in our case. Okay, so this one is given. The question is now, what is the right context for the next symbol here? And for that, what you need to do is you need to do this unfolding. In our case, I already have all these unfoldings over here. So this thing here would generate those two. So let's check. This E by itself doesn't have anything that is on its right-hand side. So it's an epsilon for the beta part of the closure. So what we need to do is we need to take into account the original look-ahead symbol. And that is the end of file symbol. So we take that as the right context for those two things. Now, previously, we could what we always did was we would ignore the marker over here because all that would yield was introducing the same productions over and over again. That is a luxury that we cannot do anymore in this LR1 automaton construction algorithm. We need to reconsider these items for E now, because, well, what happens? In the spot that we have marked here, we now have a new right context to the marked symbol. That is something that was different to this one where we originally came from. There we didn't have a right context. We could just take the original right-hand side context or look ahead symbol and transfer it to our new items. Here now we have a marked E which actually has a right-hand side context. So for those, what we need to do is we need to add new items like E goes to T with, in this case, the plus symbol as its right inside context, and even more, an E goes to bullet E plus T also with a plus symbol as its right inside context. Since that is an actual mess, what we do is in our bookkeeping, we don't actually add these things once again, but we gather all the right-hand side contexts just over here. So we add the plus symbol over here and the plus symbol over there.
Okay.
Good. So with that, we have checked all the occurrences of a bullet in front of E so far, and can continue. What we do is we continue by the expansion of T, because T is also a marked thing in there. That would add those two items into our collection. And, well, the one that we came from sports an epsilon and a plus in there, and no particular right context for the marked symbol itself. So what we do is we overtake each of the look-ahead symbol, we just copy the look-ahead symbols from the item that which we came from into our new things. So we put epsilon and plus over there, as well as for this one, we put the look-ahead symbols epsilon plus in there. Fine. Now let's check the next marker over here, and oh my god, once again, like before, we now have marked T with an actual own right context. Multiplication operator and F. So we have to adjust the look-ahead sets once again, because for these two items, these are T's, they are expandable from that thing, and they are occurring with in a context with the multiplication operator on their right. So we add the multiplication operator to those two. Good. So let's continue on. Now the different symbol, F. F leads to the introduction of those two, F and F. And there's no actual own right-hand side context. There's just nothing there. So we just copy what we have as right-hand side context so far. Same goes for this one here. Are we done? We have to check all the markers. This one is in front of a terminal, so we don't have to expand. This one is in front of a terminal, so we don't expand. So we are done with this one. This now looked pretty straightforward, just adding a lot of symbols to all the things that we have had before. But you should be careful. It's a little bit treacherous. The way that the productions are arranged in these things over here, the grammar is actually composed of, is treacherous because you never get something like a bullet in the very last item occurring directly before a non-terminal that we managed at the top of that list. If that would be the case, we might have to add a few other context symbol to the top and adjust all the others once again, because, well, in all the cases where there's no own right inside context, that would propagate. So that is kind of what you have to do there is kind of fixed point algorithm. You need to carefully add these symbols to each of the look ahead lists that you have added before, and in case that you already tried to evaluate, you need to consider them as still not completely evaluated and evaluate them again until the whole system stabilizes. Okay, let's check whether we have done everything right for... Oh, how do we do that? Yeah. So, that is what should have been created. So, there's this epsilon for each of them. There's the plus until we reach the T productions where we add the multiplication and so on. So far, is there a question on how to perform the epsilon closure? So you all can do the next ones, probably. Very well. It's a lazy afternoon for me. Good. How are the others? The other states created? Now we need to do a few transition steps in between. For example, let's have a look at how this state Q1 is created. What we do to create that is we emanate from Q0 and select any symbol which is occurring and is marked in the old state E. And for our purposes, well, we can take any old one of those, and you see that that's actually done for all of those on the slide. So just that you know where we take these symbols from. So in our case, we start with this E thing. E can be read by the canonical automaton, and that means that we pursue only a fraction of these items anymore. And these are the items that are actually have the E marked in their items. So these are those. And all we need to do for those is we need to shift the marker by one symbol. So that's what we do here. And yeah, what do we have to do with the look ahead? In case that we do read one of these symbols on the pushdown by the canonical automaton, we don't change anything in the look ahead. So all we need to do is straight copy the symbols from there over there. This. So this is now the raw material that we can now work on in order to come up with our automaton. Because for the transition, what we still need to do is we need to make sure that the closure is completed on that set of items. And turns out, here there's nothing to expand because that is already a closed item. Over here, the item is not closed, but there is a terminal symbol marked in this one, so we can't expand this one. So also nothing added to this. And well, with that, we're happy. We don't need to do anything for this in particular. And in kind of a similar fashion, we deal with this one. We take those two items, shift the marker by one, copy the look ahead, check whether we have to do closure. We don't have to, so we are done with that one also. So let's maybe change back a little bit to the presentation mode. Come on. So we can just simply fill the look ahead symbols in, and we are done. Yeah, the only one that gets a little bit more complicated is the one where we perform the shift transition with the opening brackets. So that was this thing over here, and it came from that item over here. So in that case, we end up with the marker landing directly in front of an E. And thus we have to perform the closure once again. So first of all, what we do is we take the look ahead from here to initialize the item over there, because that is what the shift transition is meant to do. And then once again, we have to perform these complete steps of closure on the state over here. And what we have to do is we have to recompute the look ahead symbols for all of those items here. So it's a little bit, well, tedious for us, because the marker is once again in front of an E, so that's the same thing as we had over here. So we have to do the whole thing that we did here also here. And yeah, that's a lot of work, but maybe we repeat it once, and on the next slides we just let it be filled in automatically. So the E things obtain their right context from here, probably. So we see in our case, the E is followed by a terminal symbol now. That is something that is different to here. So because we now have a concrete right-hand side context for the non-terminal to unfold, that is what we actually do. So we add the closing bracket to the E things, and apart from that, we see that the E occurs here in the on the left-hand side of a plus, so that will also end up being a right context. So that is kind of the same as we have seen over here, where instead of the end of file symbol, we now have the closing bracket symbol, and also the plus is added to the whole thing. And moving on, we see that T is marked, so we need to move the closing bracket and the plus symbol to the two items of T. And T is also occurring with the multiplication operator, so we add that also to the two T productions. Once again, same case as we had over here, and so on. So the closing bracket, plus, and multiplication turn out to end up in those two look-ahead symbols again. So that's what we get over here. Similar idea as before. What we need to have is we need to check for right contexts, and we need to not be fooled by similar situations. We have to always check all the preconditions of how to perform this computation of the right-hand side context. So in the end, we see that there's a lot of things now still happening, and we have to repeat these computations lots of times. And in particular, what we get is that the states that don't have a prime so far are states that are pretty similar to the LR0 states in terms of, well, they have the same item sets. The only thing that differed was that they have a look-ahead set now. But it turns out that we even managed to create completely new and unseen states that we haven't had before, like this Q5 prime, and a complete page of new states that are yielded by that. So the LR1 automaton is quite much larger than the LR0 automaton was. So, just as a kind of a graphical comparison, that was the LR0 automaton. The LR1 automaton now adds a whole lot of other states to the game, and it gets real messy with that. But in principle, it's just a thing that you would automate, and you would not look into that much anymore later on. Especially when everything works, you won't look at it at all, and just let it work. You see that in our case, where we introduced just one single piece of look-ahead symbol, the number of steps was almost doubled in our case, and that is not unusual. And it's there's even a lot of cases where they're not only doubled, but even multiplied by whatever. So you get quite a large automaton from that, and in these automatic constructions of parsers, the more look ahead, the longer look ahead window you establish for your parser, the more combinations of symbols to form a string of length 1, 2, k, whatever you choose as your look ahead, kind of explodes in an exponential fashion, and that is very bad news for your automaton size, so to say. So that's just kind of a side note. Anyway, did that solve our original issue? So if you think back what the problem was, we had some conflicts in some states of the LR0 automaton. And are they now still present in our LR1 automaton? And well, since we have a state Q9 also in our LR1 automaton, and it happens to be kind of similarly reachable in the automaton, we can just have a look at that particular one and check whether that is now better than before. And yeah, the state Q9, how does it look like? It has the two items like these. So these have also been present in the LR0 automaton. In the LR0 automaton, that thing produced a shift-reduce conflict. Why did it do that? Because we had the first item that said reduce, and the second item that said shift. So we didn't know what to do. So is that solved now by our LR1 automaton? Well, for that we need to take into account the look-ahead symbols. And those are there to guide the shift-reduce automaton, or the shift-reduce parser, in which situations to reduce and in which to shift. So where does the look-ahead actually come into importance? Well, for this thing here, the bullet is somewhere in the middle of the item. So that is telling us that there's still information about how the material on the right of the bullet has to look like in order to confirm with that item. In particular, what it gives us is that the next symbol after the bullet needs to be a multiplication operator. How does that now compare to the situation that we find over here? Here, the item itself doesn't provide any information about the right context of our bullet, but we haven't been idle in the past. Our LR1 item now also carries information about the right context of that particular item. And from that right context, we can now determine what the symbols in the look-ahead window need to be in order for that item to apply. So, and we see we have the epsilon or kind of end-of-file symbol that votes for the reduce as well as the plus operator. So, do we consider that state now as still being in conflict or not? Actually, no. And why is that? Because the right context of the reduce action intersected with the first symbol of the shift item. And I have here the complete operation that you need to do here. Informally, I was just talking about this multiplication symbol, but there might be other things where we have not only one particular symbol, but even more, and then we would need to do a one concatenation of the complete rest of the right-hand side and the remaining input. However, it turns out that first of one is already directly computable of that part, and we needn't bother with this one in that particular case. So what we can do is we can have a look at the intersection of the look-ahead set of the reduce item and the multiplication operator, and we see they don't overlap. The intersection is the empty set, and with that we can now decide whether to shift or to reduce, given that the look-ahead symbol is either a multiplication operator an endophile symbol or the plus operator. So that is now our general concept for the LR1 parser. What we how it looks like is we have the push down on which we manage our so far accomplished reconstructions of the parse tree. We have the input with its look ahead window, and what we have is we have an action table, and the action table is the one that is driven by the canonical LR1 LR1 automaton, and the go-to table that is the delta, the transitions of the automaton, and what we produce is as an output the sequence of reductions that we have have found for that particular input. So, how does this whole thing look like for the LR1 parser? It has the states of the canonical automaton and a fresh final state. It has a start state and a final state explicitly marked. Then there's a transitions in there, that is shift transitions. The shift transition is then done when the action table executed on the state that we find on top of the pushdown, together with the look ahead, say shift. In the those cases, what we do is we perform a shift action, meaning we add a new state to the pushdown that we get by performing the actual transition on the canonical automaton under the next symbol from the input, thus consuming the symbol from the input and putting the new state on the pushdown. Then there's a reduce action. When is the reduce action done? Well, in case that the state on top of the pushdown is actually reduced state. This was the states that were marked as final states in the canonical automaton, and they had a completed item in there. And the action table, that was the one that was guided by the look ahead symbol, actually tells us to reduce under a certain look ahead symbol determined by the look ahead. And in those cases, what we would do would be we would then remove as many states as we had symbols on the right-hand side of the complete item, and replace them with a new state, which you would get by going in the canonical automaton from the state that is stored on the pushdown directly under all the popped states, And starting from that state, reading the right-hand side symbol of the completed item. And that is now the state that we now put as new top of the pushdown. So it's just a formal way of writing down what we have so far come up with. Then, in a similar way as we had it before, we need to somehow reach the finishing state, and that is whenever we find that in our last remaining state on the pushdown, we actually find the completed initial item. And if that is the case, then we go over to final state. And with that, we get the LR1 parser. And it turns out that with the grammar that we have treated so far, which is just this expression grammar, instead of running into actual shift-reduce conflicts, we are now able to come up with an action table that doesn't have any conflicts anymore, and we can determine based on the next symbol in the input what action we have to do. So all the states that are marked as final states in the canonical automaton are actually context-free, meaning that this check with intersections between the shift and reduce items all turn out to be non-intersecting. Thus, we have meaningful advice whether to reduce or not. And this advice is now entered into this action table by for all of the states that we have in our canonical automaton. What we do is we evaluate what this automaton tells us to do, depending on what look ahead symbols we are confronted with. So in this column here, you find all the things that are proposed by the canonical automaton in case of the... Oh. In case of the epsilon symbol. So each of these things you see is a non-terminal together with numeric value. That means it's a reduce action with that particular rule. So, for example, that one. For example, that one tells us we have to reduce with this variant of rule F. Turns out that int is never a valid look ahead symbol for any of the final states here, so that actually doesn't matter for our purposes, same as the opening bracket. This one, the closing bracket, also gives reduce advice so far, so nothing new. But here you see there's not only reduce actions entered, but there's also these ominous pink S's, which are here for shifts. So these are the entries that tell the shift reduce or LR1 parser to actually perform a shift action instead of a reduce action. Fine. Finally, we found a way of turning our nice concept of a shift reduce parser into a deterministic automaton. But still, there's a possibility that for certain grammars you will run into reduce or shift reduce conflicts. That can happen if your grammar is just not suited for LR1 parsing. So the whole problem starts once again. You have grammars that might be suited for LR1, LR7, LR whatever, but it's just not so simple to say beforehand what K is actually suitable for such a thing. What you could theoretically do is try to enumerate all the yields of a grammar, like you've seen me in one of the example sessions last time, I think. However, that is something that you would in practice not do, because that's very tedious and error prone, and it's just a lot of work. What you would actually try to do is you would step by step try to do the constructions for LR0, LR1, LR2, LR3, and keep attention to the K where all the conflicts at once disappear, and that would be the K with which a grammar would actually work. So that would be the kind of practical approach to determining the K for such a grammar. The question is now, in practice, if you, for example, check collections of parser systems in practice, you will see that there's not so many parser generators out there that actually have a look-ahead size that exceeds this one that you have seen as construct during the last slides. That is, for once, it is a little bit different approach to the LR1 approach, because you can't do this fast computation of first sets anymore if you enlarge your look-ahead window. Also, what you get is this explosion of states, because the look-ahead sets grow so large in size. So these are all things that keep practical implementations from actually hitting the streets, anything that is larger than LR1. The question is now, there's definitely grammars, especially also for computer languages out there, that have conflicts in their LR1 states. So the question is, what do you do now in such a situation? And there are several ways of dealing with that. And I think you deserve to know what to do in such situations when you actually are confronted with these. So one of the approaches that's out there to remove conflicts from your automata is the concept of precedences and associativities. And they're out there to fix certain shift and reduce conflicts or even ambiguous grammars. And what you actually will get there is you will try to run your LR1 parser generator, and it will tell you that there are certain shift-reduce conflicts, and these conflicts in practice translate into the generation algorithm has found certain states which were in principle possible to yield you should reduce there. But it cannot definitely say that it should reduce in the cases, because there's conflicts in the look-ahead and the right context of a marked symbol. So it doesn't know what to do there. The approach of precedences and associativities is to actually manually determine what the parser generator should do in these cases, what it should enter in these action tables. And you can see an example over here. That would be this grammar. It's highly ambiguous in certain senses. Especially what you see happening is, well, if you let the LR1 parser run, you've seen the automaton construction of the canonical automaton went fine. There was an automaton there. Now, if you would transform that into an action table, meaning you would evaluate all the final states into states that would tell reduce, you would have certain fields which you could not fill in, especially those four over here. And each of these question marks now corresponds to a certain shift-reduce conflict in some of the states here. For example, what you can have a look at is the shift-reduce conflict in state 8 under, in this case, plus. So that would be this question mark over here. What is behind that? Well, you see, if you unfold what this short name Q8 actually means, it's the collection of those two items. So there is a marker in front of a plus, and there's a marker at the end, and one of the many look-ahead symbols over there. There's a few that I haven't shown, and also the first item also has look-ahead symbols, but they're not relevant for our purposes here. It's also a plus. So the question is now, should I reduce or shift in that situation? So what would be the actual situation? That would be something that you see over here. That would be a computation state that matches with that particular state of the canonical automaton. You see, there's as a complete right-hand side, on top of the stack, we have E plus E, and we see that the first symbol of the look-ahead is also a plus. The question is now, we could reduce the input. E plus E is a perfectly fine arithmetic expression, and then shift plus and eventually complete that expression also, which would lead to E plus E being reduced probably to E, and the plus would then be bound. Oh no, not like that, sorry. The plus would then be bound to the next E, which would then be used to complete a parse tree like this. If we would reduce now and kind of pursue... Sorry. This one. Choose this item over here. The other solution would be to consider that as a shifting state, which would mean that we would actually shift that plus on the push down, and eventually also another E at some point. We would combine only then to a new subtree of E, and then afterwards, in the end, probably try to connect with the original E, which would then lead to a situation like E plus E plus E. We would bind those to an E and do the rest of the tree like that. And you see, well, it's actually not easy to decide here. Both of them are valid. The problem is the grammar is ambiguous here. We have never determined what we would like to do here. So the easy solution would be to just determine the associativity of our operator plus and tell the system to always choose, well, either to reduce or to shift in that sense. And that's the correct solution for, well, that correct, you can't say you just decide on, for example, that our plus operator is left associative and that it will perform the reduction with the option, this option immediately, and not try to shift. And this would lead to our parse trees always looking in the way that we have seen for the blue solution, I think, was it? Yeah. Well, anyway, we just anyway, you fix it in one direction. In that sense, you've checked. It doesn't matter for us. It's just one kind of way of writing that down, and we have to decide on a tree. Although the whole thing is not a tree, but kind of a sequence. So we just need to fix it in one way. And yeah, turns out that we get the same problem as we had for the addition operator, also for the multiplication operator. This one also. Has a shift-reduce conflict for the same reason, and just to make something different as before, I just determine the whole thing to be right associative for no reason at all. But here you go, and this means that in that case I would put in shift instead of the reduce action, but well, you can just choose whatever you would like. So, there's still two question marks remaining, and if we have a look at those, we will see, well, there's one shift-reduce conflict between items under the symbol of multiplication, that is those two, and there's one under the symbol of addition. And if you have a look at the computation states that lie behind the whole thing, these are situations where you start expressions once with multiplication and once with addition, and then continue with addition and with multiplication. So it's alternating operators. And that is actually a question of which of the operators would like to bind more. And for those, it actually matters how you construct your parse trees. So here it is important to not decide in an arbitrary fashion, but you actually need to decide in a meaningful way. And for our purposes, what we would like to do is, of course, we would like the multiplication operator to bind stronger than the plus operator. The problem is with associativity, we can't really do that. So we need to do something different here, and that is what this precedences concept is about. You would need to define the precedence of the multiplication operator higher than the precedence of the addition operator. So how would that actually work internally? You would specify a kind of a sequence of operators, and the ones that are occurring higher in the sequence would be considered to be of higher precedence than the ones with that come after, and that way you would guide the system to set the entries that we're still missing in our table in a way such that the multiplication would be the preferred binding. That, which would mean that in Q7, I think that was Q7, what you would do is you would prefer to reduce with E1, so you would prefer this thing, while in Q8, which is this thing over here, you would prefer to shift, which would prefer the first alternative, which is well also the one with the multiplication operation. So that is one way of dealing with all that, but that is still somehow depending on the concept of having a look ahead of only one symbol. There's a few, or well, not a few, but there's the possibility for shift-reduced conflicts that cannot be decided in such a fashion as here, because they are not actually caused by these aspects of precedence or associativity, but just pure size of the input window. So, what could you do for those? For example, let's have a look at an example grammar where we are limited by our look ahead of one, and a prominent example for that would be one that turned, for example, the Java grammar between Java 1.4 and 1.5, or even a little bit later, I don't exactly remember, from a look ahead of one to look ahead of two. There was this the introduction of lambda expressions in there, and for those you would have to support certain grammatical structures like the ones that you see over here in your expressions. What you would have to feature would for once be the ordinary expressions that would support just arithmetic expressions and class access expressions and all the usual ones that you know. But now there's there would also be the definition of lambda expressions in there. And yeah, if you just look at those from a kind of a grammatical point of view, you could try to derive your right derivations and try to locate the handles like we have had in the previous times, and you see that in order to decide what to do with that specific handle, whether you would reduce with one variant or the other, especially you see there's the ident used over here that would be reduced to an identifier list, or the identifier over here that would be reduced to an args, or the ident over here that would be reduced to an e. In order to decide that, you would need to have a look at the symbols that you find to the right. So you see here we have a closing bracket, here we have a closing bracket. Nah, that means we have to look even further. Here there is an arrow, here there's nothing. So you see you need to look two symbols to the right in order to decide which of the variants is used for reduction over here. So that could turn out to be a nasty thing. In principle, you would need to have a look ahead of length 2 in order to decide that. But there's kind of a naive practical idea of cheating away around that. You see it sketched over here. It would be to have a kind of a Pullman's LR2 algorithm by, well, identifying that in these situations we always have the same two symbols coming after each other. It's two terminals, and well, why do we actually keep them as separate symbols? If we put them into one symbol, we can decide by just looking at this and this thing over here which of those two alternatives it actually is. So the thing would be to cheat by altering your lexical definitions and introduce a new kind of large-scale token that is considered to be a singular token, and with that you can kind of manage your way around these problems. In this case, that is an obvious solution. But in general, that might be not as simple as that. And the general way of dealing with that would be a special idea that a few people had, which is Mikunas, Schneider, and a few other people. And they came up with a clever way of transforming your grammars in a way that you could reduce the amount of look-ahead that is necessary to decide your reduction or shift or reduce states. And it would just reduce the amount of look-ahead that, that you would need in the end. It would, if you repeatedly applied the their core idea that they have, you can reduce the an arbitrary fixed number of look-ahead symbols that you need into a grammar that needs only a look-ahead of one. And then there's even a special case where you can come up with in certain. If your grammar has certain properties, then you can even do without any look-ahead at all. So, what is all that about? It's a pretty lengthy and pretty formal approach that they present in their paper, so I will not give you the complete thing, but just kind of an example of how to do that for a very limited purpose. Also, the examples grow larger and larger and larger if you have a look at the full thing, but I think you can get the core idea of what they have about conflict resolving from that. So, the idea would be to go from LR2 to LR1, starting with the example that you see here, and without looking too much into what that actually means, we can, first of all, check the source of the problem and what look-ahead would be necessary to tackle this grammar with an LR parser. And for that you could determine the sentence forms that you could derive with that kind of grammar, and that would be those ones over here. And you quite quickly see that a concrete example here. You once again have two sentence forms, and you have identified the is it this one? No, sorry, that was not the ones that I wanted. These over here. Yeah, where you have identified the handle. That is the last right-hand side that was produced by one of these derivation steps. And you would need to decide on how to reduce them once again. But you see the next item following the input is in both cases a B, and only the second one that comes there is differentiating between those two. So only with a look-ahead of two you can decide how it would reduce, so the whole thing would tend to be an LR2 grammar. So, what should you do there? The idea of Mikunas and Schneider and consorts would be to kind of generalize this idea of tricking your parser into somehow moving the symbol that you decide upon whether you want to reduce or not more in the direct neighborhood of the actual handle on which you need to decide. What does that mean for us? It would mean that the technique would in principle goes like this. The terminal symbol with which you could actually decide whether to how to reduce or shift or whatever would originally be found not at the beginning of your remaining input, but somewhere further to the right. So what you would do is you would take the symbol in front of the one that is responsible for deciding whether to reduce with each or the other, and move it out of its original subtree somewhere there until it is it is also a child of the same subtree in which we actually have to decide how to reduce, and then move it back down, but this time directly into the right hand side of the productions which we have to decide whether we have to reduce with one or the other alternative. What does that help? That helps in that the original symbol on which we which gives us advice how to decide is now not somewhere in the middle of the remaining input, but step by step advances to the beginning of the remaining input until it reaches the look-ahead window. So what you do is you don't enlarge your look-ahead window, but you adapt the way that your parse trees look like such that the symbols that decide how to reduce can actually be captured within your look-ahead window. And that is done by transforming the grammar which you use for parsing with these procedures that you see annotated over here, which is this right context extraction and the right context propagation. So one is pulling it up and the other one is pushing it down. In our example, what we had given was that on the look-ahead B, the productions A1 and B1, as well as A0 and B0, were conflicting. So, what would we do? This is an example where the right context, which is this B, is already or can already be found in a situation like this. The B is already directly in front of the A or the B over here. So we don't need to perform anything like moving it up there. So what we only need to do is to do right context propagation. How does that work? Well, what we do is we don't use the original A anymore, but we use an adapted A, which we call A with B already integrated. So that is this. We don't need to keep the B now anymore as a separate symbol because we consider that to be already managed by this newly introduced productions. Now we need to give how these things actually look like. So we introduce productions for these new right context propagated symbols. This AB now looks like, well, the original A with just, instead of A here, we append the symbol which we push down into the subtree. And in the same fashion, we would, in principle, do something like AB over here, but since with that we would still have a spot in our grammar where the B is following a large A directly, and that was a conflict creation spot for us. So this is on the fly directly also converted into one of these new arbitrary things. I can just do so because in these AB things we actually have the B already integrated, and with that we get to this form. And in a recursive fashion, we consider this B already being integrated over there, and yeah, we're done with that part of our thing. But still, we need to integrate production for BB, which looks quite similar as the one we had before. And now what we only need to add is the original things, because this part of our grammar might be just a subset of a larger grammar that also has A or B somewhere else, and maybe not followed with a small b, thus not creating a conflict, and still leading to the old way of productions. But turns out that in our case there was no such thing, so the old productions are actually unreachable from everything that remains here, and we can just drop them away, so to say. Good. With that thing, we can now rename these artificially introduced non-terminals with fresh names. So I choose this A prime and B prime, and yeah, with that we get a new grammar, which looks not so different from the old one. But turns out that when I do my construction of the rightmost derivations, the ones that were actually conflicting before was this one and this one, and we now see B is now part of the handle. So if we use our look ahead, we can directly use the thing that comes after the handle, which is was in the grammar before, was found two symbols to the right and not one symbol to the right, as in this one. So for that grammar here, we can decide by just reading one input symbol in our look ahead, and thus we have a grammar that is now LR1. So that would be the way to go. There's a little time left, so let's continue on. I have a second example, and this one now, there's once again a lot of things that I've pre-done. I've constructed these rightmost derivations. Turns out it's at minimum LR2. There's a lot of other things over there that can be produced with that things, but it's not of interest for us at that point here. We just want to remove the shift-reduce conflicts that are created from those actual states. So for these, the thing is that the A, which is the right context for this variant of the production, is not directly present at the point where its left-hand side occurs in the grammar. What does that mean? Well, this S can occur, for example, here. And yeah, you don't directly find the A as a symbol following over here. So if we go back to this situation, we don't have this initial situation, but this initial situation. So we still need to push these a symbol from the look ahead into a common root node, so to say. And we do so by performing the so-called right context extraction. And for that, we need to locate the spots in S that can the spots in our grammar where this S actually occurs, and where the following symbol then has a first symbol of A, because that is the symbol which conflicts. So in order to do so, we need to write context extract A
from this
symbol over here, which is, funnily enough, also an S. But yeah, anyway, so what we need to do is we need to make this A terminal occurring there explicitly. How can we do that? We well, this S does not necessarily start with an A symbol, so we need to, instead of keep one alternative, we need to introduce two. One where A is the actual first symbol, and another alternative where we make all the other symbols explicit that might be first symbols of S. So that is that case here, because S can not only start with A but also with B. So apart from that, because we added a symbol here, we are not, we still mean to generate the same input from there. We need to remove this A from somewhere, and we remove it from the following symbol. Same goes for the B. So we introduce a new set of non-terminals once again, for which we need to provide productions, and that's what we do next. So this S without A, that's how you would read that name for the non-terminal, would look like the old productions from S, where the A has been before, now lack this A, but have the same suffix as before, so that produces that kind of productions, and same for S without B. That removes the B from there and introduces the production that just goes to the suffix of the whole thing. So that is the old three variants for S, just split between all the ones where A is in front and the ones where B is in front. Okay, so with that, we still need to, well, because you see, we still have the situation where two S are one after each other. That was the same situation as here, where we had conflicts arising. So we do the same transformation as we have done before. Now we introduce the same symbols as before, and since we have already provided things from for those, we are then done. So you see there's a little bit of recursion in there, but in principle what you do is just you pull out terminal symbols from productions. And then you would need to continue in the same way as we did for example one. We would need to then push down the newly extracted symbols once again. So the symbol A would then have to be pushed into S. For B, we don't need to do that because B was not a conflicting terminal. So pushing A into S would result into introducing these new non-terminals S with A, and they would need to look like, for example, this one over here, and then I think, is there already everything in? Oh, no, there's still, yeah, there's still another situation. Oh, this was like this. There's still an A that follows S. It's a little bit masked because the S over here had its A subtracted before. So it's a little bit difficult to see beforehand, but yeah, would work like that. And with that, I think, yeah, you still need to do the same for B, but finally you reach a fixed point in the whole system. And you see, contrary to the example before, we have quite bloated our grammar. There's a lot of new symbols introduced, and you cannot identify the original structure anymore so well. But turns out that is... Now, a grammar that is able to be LR1 parsable. And yeah, be it as it be, you might not want to do that kind of transformation by hand each time you engineer such a grammar, because you completely lose your intuition of what all these productions actually look like. But don't underestimate the power of that approach, because there's approaches out there that let you provide the left part of the grammar with all the LR2, LR3, and whatever conflicts in there, and internally perform this transformation into a grammar that is able to be LR1 parsable. And they use the result that they get from this new grammar in order to obtain advice for the old grammar on how to decide whether to reduce or to shift. So on the surface, you still seem to be using the old grammar. You can still specify your actions for reductions in there. And internally, it produces all the adapted productions for your grammar. And there's an LR1 parser, and you're fine with that. The actual... we're over time already. So we'll do that next time. It's not so much that's left, actually, but... Then we can also proceed with giving out the topics for the tutorials. With that, I would like to conclude today. Thank you for your attention, and see us all next week. Tutorial is again next week on Thursday morning and in the evening. So have a nice week. Enjoy. Well, it's not so much left of the good weather, but... we'll see us again next week. Thank you and goodbye.